From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
You're in a small, confined space with someone like me, a center-right person, undecided, and you're making the case for why they ought to vote for you. What is that case?
Well, it starts with the fact that myself and my running mate, Bill Weld, are two former Republican governors.
Every time I think about Trump, I get allergic.
Gunfire in Grant Park overnight as Chicago police deal with an incredibly violent August with the highest number of murders in two decades.
It is in the eight figures, tens of millions of dollars. That's how much money former anchor Gretchen Carlson is reportedly collecting from Fox News.
Let me say that we're here in part because we know how important this election is to Ohio.
Oh, dear. Get a lozenge. A little bit of the week's news out of context today on The Wheelhouse. You can join us 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. But an awful lot of those stories you just heard about, those are things we won't really be talking about today because, you know, there's so much other national news that you can hear about in other places like NPR. But there's an awful lot happening at the state capitol. And so we want to bring in Keith Faniff, budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org. Hi there, Keith.
Good morning.
Danielle Altamari, State House reporter at the Hartford Courant. Hi there, Danielle. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Good. And back from a week of being away, the great Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Really good to see you once again, Colin. Oh, great. You must have picked up something while you're off. Hey, let's start with the key, with the state budget,
sure.
Keith, because this is really – we almost call it the Keith.
I'm down with the Keith.
You're
it's
down
a
with
new
the
show
Keith.
On Fox this fall.
Comptroller Kevin Lembo released a report last week, the first monthly report on the new state budget. He warned about projections around income tax revenue, which he called the biggest source of revenue volatility, no surprise, especially surrounding money coming in from the financial sector. So what all did the report say about the budget?
Well, I think what the comptroller is doing is sort of letting everybody know up front, if things go bad, don't say I didn't warn you. Unfortunately, the things in this report are things that people were talking about in May, and that's not taking anything away from the comptroller. But people are forgetting them. When this budget was adopted, we leave ourselves no margin for error. If somehow you could leave even less than zero margin for error, that's what we do. This budget counted on – the governor said he was going to have 2,000 layoffs completed by June 10th so we could have the full savings in the next fiscal year. To date, we've only had about half of that, and we're now 3 months in. Shortly after we adopted the budget, we downgraded our expectations for the income tax, for the sales tax, and now there's questions about corporation tax revenues. So – I mean, this budget appeared to be bleeding a certain amount of red ink before we even hit July 1.
Okay. So and as you said, Keith, a lot of these things we knew going in, so you're not terribly surprised. Real quick question, Danielle. Why only half the layoffs? I mean, why haven't we had all the layoffs that we expected to have?
Interesting question, Keith. Do you know the answer to that?
It all comes down to the Keith. There's a couple things. Most of our bargain. We can talk tough about, oh, we're going to do all these layoffs. But the fact of the matter is state government isn't as fat as people think. First off, DC Department of Children and Families has been under federal court monitors control since the early 1990s. DSS is getting sued because of problems with Medicaid, because of problems with food stamps. DOT has the same amount of architects and engineers they had 6 years ago when the Program Review Committee said they can't get projects done on time and under budget. And many of our large bargaining units have contract language that says you can lay people off if you're getting rid of a program. But if you want to turn it over to the private sector, no. And all of these things make it, you know, it's easy to talk about layoffs. It's very hard to carry them out.
And the unions have also said, you know, that some of the layoffs that have taken place, certainly in the judicial branch, have unfairly targeted sort of the lower level folks and not, you know, the middle managers or the upper folks. They've said that, you know, across the board, it's been kind of unfair to them.
And the bitter lesson of this might be that layoffs weren't really the right answer. I mean, for all of the reasons that Keith and Daniela have said, I mean, you can. Lay your way off or lay off your way – I can't even talk anymore. I lost my power of speech up in Maine. You can get a little way out of this hole by laying people off, but you can't get all the way out of this hole by laying people off. And at a certain point, you do hit this critical snapping point where your ability to deliver significant state services – is deteriorating to a point where you're creating problems that you're going to have to deal with down the road too. You know, and I don't know. I keep going back to the fact that probably it made more sense to try to work with the state labor force, which is notably recalcitrant about this kind of thing, for across-the-board reductions in salary and benefits, you know, because now otherwise it becomes this kind of all-or-nothing thing. If you don't fix it across the board, then you have to start laying people off. And then you start running into these roadblocks. Some of them are contractual and some of them are practical and some of them are the result of court monitoring. You know, this is probably not the way to fix state government.
But I guess I'll just ask, Keith, when you said of all the problems that were foreseen back in May, back when this budget went through, among those concerns was perhaps we can't make the layoffs we say we're going to make. I mean, that there are these roadblocks in place. At the end of the day, if these are layoffs that couldn't have been made anyway, how is it we possibly swallowed the notion that that is how we would cut our way to a balanced budget?
It's a very good question. Let me respond with another one. And I'll put this all in terms of numbers of layoffs. The governor talked about 2,000 layoffs. The legislature budgeted enough savings for about 3,500 to 4,000 layoffs, and we've only achieved 1,000 layoffs. So if you follow the bouncing ball, he promised two. They planned on the savings from double that amount. Why did they do that? Because it's late May, you're trying to get the budget done, and you can't cut anything else, or you can't get the support to cut anything else. So you build in what some critics would call a phantom cut, and then it makes it worse when the governor can't even hit the number he talked about. And so you have the I'm hitting things. I'm sorry. You have the.
You're getting upset. No one blames you either.
It's noisy in the Keith. And now you have the comptroller just going on record as saying, guys, hey, before these things start, you know, cropping up, I know we just started totaling the numbers, so I'm not going to report a deficit now. But, you know, I'm calling out some warning signs.
Calling out some warning signs. I guess you just have to ask, and I'll start with you, Keith. But, you know, at the start of this, though, these numbers that Kevin Lembo is talking about, he talks about, once again, not meeting the projections for income tax revenues. And like over the course of the last couple of years, I don't know how many times I've said something quite like that. Why is it that we don't know how much we're going to get from the income tax anymore? We stopped being able to do that some time, and I don't know why it happened. Did we lose a superpower or something?
Yeah, no. I mean, of course, it's never perfect because we're talking about a revenue engine that brings in $9.5 to $10 billion a year. So I get that. And the capital gains part of the income tax, you know, John, is very volatile.
It is.
But it's wishful thinking that takes over. When you really can't get people to accept the level of budget cuts, but yet you want to tell the voters we're all about austerity, and they can't just make it work. So they're trying to spread too little butter over too much bread.
Colin?
Well, I mean, another hint would probably be that it's rarely the other thing, right? It's rarely, wow, it's coming in a lot faster than we thought. I'm not saying that never happens, but I mean, it's the percentage.
Since 2008.
Yeah. So, I mean, that should tell you something, right? I mean, it's pretty easy to diagnose the disease right there.
But I will say that another piece of this, Daniela, is just that not only do we not seem to know anymore how much money we're going to get from the income tax, we don't have any real structural way to budget year on end. We're not exactly sure where the money's going to come from in the future. As we look into another legislative session that is going to come right after another election in just a couple months here, I mean, what do we see? Is there anybody at the state capitol talking about this particular problem that we're outlining right now and how we might fix it?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first off, I think everybody is continues to still be surprised at the slow pace of the recovery here. There's still so many people who aren't working or aren't working full time, or so I'm sure that factors into the income tax issue. And then, you know, yeah, I mean, Keith is right. You know, these folks are politicians, so they're not necessarily used to taking the long view. And all you have to do is come up to the Capitol in the last few days of the session to see it in action. Where there's just, you know, crazed panic, let's patch this hole and throw this number up. And yeah, maybe it's not based in reality, but it'll get us to midnight on, you know, closing night of the session. That's really kind of the mindset over there.
And a thing to just remember, Colin, is when we talk about all the various rosy projections of how the economy was going to recover that have been made since 2008, none was perhaps rosier than Tom Foley, who assumed that the economy would be even better than it was. So for as much as we may say that Ben Barnes and Dan Malloy haven't exactly gotten the numbers right as far as how much we're going to be getting from income taxes and how much the economy is going to recover, the other guy thought it was going to be a hell of a lot better than this.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't summon a lot of animus in my heart for Tom Foley right now. I don't think he's the author of our problems. But, you know, I mean, what we are seeing is this kind of alarming China syndrome where these problems are beginning to build on one another. They've been doing that for a long time. So you've got an economy that's not responsive compared to, say, Massachusetts and New York, which are, you know, pretty easily comparable in neighboring states with, you know, similar kinds of economy. So it's not bouncing back at that level. And meanwhile, you can't, under those circumstances, impose more tax burdens on a struggling population. Meanwhile, services start to deteriorate. Services that deteriorate tend to create more problems. In other words, you know, you remove the people who are doing direct services at CTJS, you know, the youth prison. You start maybe talking about even closing that place, even though it's become a pretty good deliverer of services to a population who needs them. They're going to create more problems down the line. You know, I mean, some of the programs that we have that amount to interventions or attempts to get a handle on a problem before it becomes a bigger problem, and we can look at this across state departments. As you begin to cut those and eviscerate those, you're buying more trouble down the road, too. There's more services you're going to have to deliver a few years out.
Well, and I'll ask you, Keith, in terms of people actually looking at things, I asked Danielle about this. I mean, is anybody trying to grapple right now with this problem? There are people at the state capitol trying to grapple with, say, the state's spending cap. One of the questions is, you know, how much exactly are we allowed to spend? The spending cap is this kind of mythical idea. What are people finding as they consider the state spending cap?
They're finding that Connecticut is up the creek and there is not a paddle anywhere in sight. The problem is,
you're so rosy.
you can't avoid the fact that over the next 20 years, Connecticut is going to try to make up for 70 years of inadequate savings for pension and retirement health care benefits. It is a massive bill that is coming due. And by the way, unless the unions give us permission for the luxury of passing off a portion of that burden to our kids and grandkids, it's going to be a bill that grows faster than any economic growth, tax increases, and budget cuts combined can smooth out. So when you look at that and then you say, well, I'd really like to limit growth at 1.5%. You know, I say I really would have liked to have a mini bike when I was 10, but I found life was filled with disappointment. You're going to find that, I mean, people are looking at it and they're talking in terms of political positions, but nobody's been able to reconcile those positions with the math.
Mm. Well, one of the other ideas that have been floated for quite some time now, Daniela, is the idea that maybe just the way the state works doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, maybe if towns could get together and regionalize and have different sorts of government structures, things would make more sense. And so the Connecticut Council of Municipalities has announced the formation of a state-local partnership panel to, quote, find ways to ease burdens on property taxpayers, diversify local options to raise revenue, and deliver services regionally. This is something that was trumpeted for quite some time by the outgoing Speaker of the House, Brendan Sharkey. Are we looking at more ideas around regionalism, whatever the word is, this upcoming legislative session?
You know, that's been, you know, for decades now, that's been the answer. Well, we'll regionalize. And it's very, very hard. I mean, you know, Keith and I both covered local communities in Connecticut, and that independence runs very, very deep. And these are, you know, in general, you know, all these towns in Connecticut are fairly small compared with other, you know, places in the country. And they have a really strongly defined sense of themselves. And the idea of regionalizing even, you know, dispatch services and things like that, you know, has taken a long time to really take hold. So, you know, as far as, you know, the really costly things that government provides, you know, like education, I mean, again, good luck with that. Sharkey, you know, one of the things he was big on is, you know, as you pointed out, regionalization. And I remember going to one of the meetings and it was just the idea of regionalizing, you know, school calendars or making them, you know, making them uniform. And that was just such a tough nut, well, that alone.
We'll call that small R regionalization. I mean, the thing that you weren't here for last week, Colin, that we touched on a little bit is the big R regionalization that Luke Bronin and people in cities like Hartford are saying is, look, we bear an awful lot of burden that the outlying towns that partake in some of our services should be helping us pay for. Is there an argument to be made that even if we're not going to be able to share school bus schedules the same way between two outlying towns, that maybe we come to the table around something to fix some of the problems of the city of Hartford by getting the surrounding communities to help more?
I think it's a difficult political sell, and for all of the reasons that Daniela just said. I mean, it's difficult to get people motivated to do even solutions that amount to nibbling around the edges of the problems that all municipalities face. And, of course, the problems that Hartford faces are gigantic. The things that you would really have to do, first of all, would take a long time to implement and cost money to start up. I mean, let's say you wanted to regionalize, say, fire department services, which probably actually makes a little bit of sense. But that's, first of all, a very tough sell for all the reasons that Daniela just said. I covered a small town, too, 82 decades ago, and so I know how independent they are and how reluctant they would be to consider something like that. And then to do it would cost money. I mean, at a time when there isn't a lot of money to spend, you'd have to spend money on regionalization and then reap its rewards gradually over time. So for Hartford, which is in an emergency state right now, I mean, I think it's in a state of fiscal emergency, it's a great long-term solution if you could get anybody to go along with it, I think, which is going to be very difficult. It's not a good short-term solution. I mean, maybe you can regionalize some purchasing functions and stuff like that. I mean, it just seems like it makes really basic kinds of sense and actually leverage greater purchasing powers. Maybe short term you can do something like that. It's not a big fix. The one other thing I'll say is that the only reason that this new panel exists or that this new initiative exists is because they're scared. They're scared because their state municipal aid is going down. And ideally, if the legislators had any backbone and weren't beholden to the precise constituencies that are affected by this, they'd really put a gun to people's heads and say, you're not getting any state aid unless you show efficiencies at a regional or a countywide level. You won't get any money at all. Your money is tied to becoming more efficient and becoming less idiotically dependent on this 169-town notion of what the state is. Unfortunately, the people who would have to say that are precisely the people incapable of saying that.
Just quick add. I love when Colin said it's a difficult political sell. Part of the reason is because right now the Capitol is still sending out mixed messages. They are still trying to leave people with the idea that this big bill is not out there. I'll just give you a few quick examples. The last gubernatorial campaign, everybody and his brother was promising tax cuts. Some of them had already been adopted before the election. After the election, no change in the deficit, but that big deficit is there. And all these tax cuts are canceled or suspended and replaced with tax hikes. And people felt like, well, that's bait and switch. Then they offer us a big transportation initiative, 30 years. Most people don't know, 25 years of it still is not funded. And the sales tax money that was supposed to cover the first 5 years now only covers three. 2 years from now, the special transportation fund goes into the red. That is your entire 30-year mega transportation initiative. And the last one, we're going to share sales tax money with the towns. Don't worry, we have enough. This year was the first year the towns were supposed to get a big chunk, about $250 million. Instead, they got about 180, and two-thirds of that we basically took from other municipal grants and slid over. In other words, we broke into the town's wallets to buy them their birthday present.
Okay, so given everything –
with those false expectations, though, people don't want – how are you going to sell something and tell people, look, we're really in tough times when you keep saying, no, those tax cuts, that sales tax money, that, you know, new Hartford viaduct is just right around the corner. It's not.
What Keith is saying is that our government is the worst drunk stepdad ever.
They don't manage expectations at all.
Oh, okay, so given all of this, why would anybody ever want to go into the legislative or executive branch? Well, maybe, just maybe, because you might find a cushy job at a quasi-public at some point. When we come back, we'll be talking about that and more with Keith Fanta from the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking about the week's news with Danielle Altamari from the Hartford Courant. She's a State House reporter there. Keith Vanoff is the budget reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. And Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, pray tell, Colin, what is on your show this afternoon?
We have the perfect segue from Keith Vanoff talking about the budget. We're doing a show about horror. And the existence of the genre. When you think about it, like, why does it even exist? You know, sure. Why are there movies like Saw? Why are there movies like The Babadook? Why are they? Why do they even exist? And then we're going to peel back a little bit. So, some of the subtext, they're often about anxieties that we have about the state budget, but we just make the Amityville Horror instead. Also talk a little bit about gender in horror movies.
I'm glad you mentioned The Babadook. That is a scary movie.
Yeah.
That is an actual scary movie.
That's, so I hear.
That's it this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Very quickly, before we turn back to some more interesting state news, Daniela, you had written about a few Connecticut members of the congressional delegation who helped to stage the sit-in on the floor of the House. They're now waiting for their punishment. Of course, Republicans control the House. So what's going to happen to, like, Elizabeth Esty and John Larson?
Well, we may find out this week. Republicans are definitely saying they're gonna be some consequences for the behavior. And I think the Democrats are kind of like, you know we violated the rules. And you know what? If you punish us, that's another round of headlines and another big push for our cause of, you know, bringing more gun control.
Well, what would punishment look like? Is it standing in the corner for some
amount of time? No TV privileges for you, young lady.
TV? Is it you go to your room without your dinner? What is it?
I'm not really sure. I mean, they, you know, the Freedom Caucus, which, you know, drives.
And I'm just going to ask you to stop. The group that is going to punish them for speaking out on the floor of the House is called the Freedom Caucus?
Well, that's the most concern. They're the ones that are pushing for this. They're the ones that are sort of driving.
The Freedom Caucus. Okay. So please continue. Yes.
So, you know, supposedly, you know, it's one of their first things on their agenda when they come back to Washington, which they did yesterday. So we'll find out. But I know Representative Esty and Larson are waiting.
My sources tell me that John Larson will not be allowed to play Halo for a month. All
just
right.
Don't take away his bocce tournament.
Oh, God. So there you go. So we'll definitely be watching for that. Now, back to the state. Ann Noble resigned last Tuesday. She was president and CEO of the Connecticut Lottery Corporation. She'll be staying on as a senior advisor and getting quite a nice package on her way out. This comes from the Hartford Courant. A Noble, who owns $206,000, will remain as CEO until September 22nd. After that, she will stay on as a senior advisor to the lottery board at the same rate of pay. And then at that point, she'll be fully vested for state retirement benefits. Here's Connecticut Lottery Board Chair Frank Farriker talking about Noble.
I think Ann's legacy has been to turn the Connecticut Lottery into a very significant source of revenue for the state, and especially in these times that we have created such a positive legacy. We're such a strong lottery, not only for the state, but nationally as well, trendsetters in so many different ways. I mean, she's certainly going to be remembered for a long time for that innovation and for moving the lottery, as she said, you know, into the next level.
As she serves as this independent consultant, she'll get a rate of about $25,000 a month. She'll also receive a previously scheduled $21,220 incentive bonus in October. Very quickly, Daniela, is this the way it's supposed to work?
Well, some people would argue that is the way it works in state government. Whether it's supposed to work that way, we're not sure, but so, there's certainly precedent here.
Colin?
Oy. I mean, apropos of our horror show, this is the point where my head, a la Linda Blair, spins 360 degrees around and I vomit pea soup.
Unfortunately, okay. CTN is not here today. Yeah. You cannot see this.
Right. So, you know, this is and isn't state government. Let's start there. This used to be a state agency. Mm-hmm. In 1996, it was turned into a quasi-public. The reason it got turned into a quasi-public really is so they can do stuff like this, so that whatever minimal rules against largesse and insanity exist within the regulated confines of state agencies, and they are, as we've sort of effectively established earlier in the show today, not great. Those go completely out the window here. So, I mean, this is everything about this is crazy. The notion that Ann Noble has to be kept on while they find her replacement flies in the face of the history of finding people's replacements. I mean, if you had to do that every time, you know, it would be kind of unworkable. So that's one of the rationales that's exhibited. The idea that she's done a great job, I don't know whether that's true or not, but let's face it, this is a monopoly. This is a quasi-public agency that has a monopoly on a kind of business that people used to kill each other to get a piece of back when it belonged to the underworld, you know. So the notion that you couldn't do a good job running an agency like this is a little bit fanciful. So I'm very sympathetic to all this, certainly at a time when, you know, the kinds of budget constraints that we're talking about, which somehow or other do trickle out and connect, you know, in a tiny little way with these quasi-publics. The idea that there's money to throw around at crap like this is absurd.
Well, there's money to throw around, Keith, and including the money. So there's a $21,000 incentive bonus. An incentive bonus suggests the sort of thing you get at a private company. And a private company is sort of what a quasi-public is, but it's also kind of a public company. A public place like, I don't know, the state government is the sort of place where you get lifetime state retirement benefits. And that's sort of the crux here, isn't it, that we've somehow created a system by which people can both get everything that you get from being a state employee and get a lot of what you get from working in the private sector all at the same time. And it's for selling $1 scratch tickets to people.
Yeah, a quasi-public is supposed to be the best of both worlds, but it's supposed to be the best of both worlds from the perspective of the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's and I should say,
yes.
I loved this story. I wanted to ask Daniela after this point if she could talk a little bit about the arrangement for the pension as well. But it's supposed to be a situation where you have agencies that can make more innovative business moves to make more money, but yet you still have a certain degree of oversight from state government. That's supposed to be the advantage of a quasi-public. I just want to ask Danielle, wasn't there some type of special arrangement made so that Ann Noble would qualify for her pension after she basically stops doing her regular job?
Yeah. Yeah, so she will be vested at the 10-year mark. So that's part of what this extension is. There's a very lengthy agreement, settlement agreement, or you know, some type of a package that was negotiated in the lottery. You know, to give credit where it's due, they did hand that out to the media who was at the meeting, and you know, everything was done openly.
Let's be clear. Also, they're under investigation right now. They're not going out in a blaze of glory on this one. They've got a pretty significant in-house problem here.
Yeah, and there's some question as to what role that investigation played. And Farriker, the head of the board, said basically, you know, it was wearing on her. Whether it caused her to leave, we don't know.
Keith?
Just real quick, that's another example, though, of the mixed message when people are told, okay, we've got to tighten our belt, but then they see, okay, well, we can create this other type of consultant job so that this person will qualify for what will be probably a pretty lucrative state pension based upon her salary. Those are the types of things that lead people to say, well, how much money can we owe if we're doing that?
Well, and we're going to turn in a second to another quasi-public called Connecticut Innovations. But I just want to say that you mentioned, Keith, earlier that the notion behind this is that you would be incentivized under quasi-public to make the sort of innovative business moves that you would need to be competitive. But again, I will just say, and I want to make sure I don't understand the lottery business all that well. I think it works kind of like this. You are part of a multi-state agency or a multi-state group that does things like Powerball, and you sell an awful lot of Powerball tickets. You have scratch tickets in lots and lots of locations where people who don't have the wherewithal to actually be spending the money on these scratch tickets spend lots of money on these scratch tickets. That is, I believe, the business model. Is there something I am missing about the business
Keno
model? Oh, there's Keno. That's right. The Keno that has just started this time.
And that was, again, one of the things that the lottery board chairman praised Ann Noble for, rolling out Keno with very few issues.
And quasi-public is really kind of a myth. It's more a situation where you're square or you're not, you're pregnant or you're not. You're still created by the General Assembly. So whatever they create, they can disintegrate.
Can I say one thing about that, too? Equally reprehensible are the responses from state government, because Keith's right. I mean, this it is a state. She's qualifying for a state pension right now. You know,
yes.
You couldn't do that if you worked for Subway. So she, these people, they do. They work for the state. It's a quasi-public, but it is a state agency. And then you get Malloy's office going, well, we don't really know anything about this. We don't, there's, you know, I mean, their response was kind of, well, this is like a quasi-public, so there's really nothing we can do. You know, and then Bob Duff is going, well, it's the first time I've ever heard about that. Well, you know what? You should all be thrown out of office. If you can't get a handle on this, this isn't a bunch of Martians. These are people who are effectively working for the state of Connecticut. They are beholden to and should be responsive to the taxpayers of Connecticut. And if you, the governor or the majority leader or the speaker or whoever you are, if you can't throw a lasso around this thing, you should be driven out of office and look at somebody who can.
Yeah, and they're subject to the state auditors just like any other department. So there is actually information out there for people who want to follow them. Legislators who care, get these audits.
Let's turn to another quasi-public agency, Connecticut Innovations.
I'm gonna have a stroke.
Has given a $75,000 consulting contract.
Budget's looking pretty good now.
Connecticut Innovations has given a $75,000 consulting contract to a former legislator who, John Lender noted in his current article, was a school teacher and administrator. He's never worked in business. Here's a little bit from John Lender's article. CI, this is Connecticut Innovations, hasn't had a lot of extra cash to throw around lately. It laid off 19 people in 6 months before retaining Gary LeBeau. So here's a question. Does it turn out that CI, the state's economic development engine of the future, is really made with spare parts from the old political patronage machine? John seems to be answering his own question there. But this is another fascinating John Lender piece in the Hartford Current, Daniela.
Yeah. And, you know, it does. It raises a lot of questions, you know. This idea that state government is this patronage mill. I mean, another Lender column we had a couple weeks before was about the two kids who, you know, got these jobs. I mean, it's just, you know, it just reinforces and builds in a real sense of cynicism. As Keith had pointed out, you know, we're in dire financial straits. There's a lot of issues. There's a lot of pain from, you know, the parents of developmentally disabled adults who, you know, can't find care for their, you know, aging children to, you know, all kinds of, you know, cutbacks, state employees losing their jobs. And yet then we see examples like this and the lottery and the kids and all this stuff. And it just feeds this cynicism.
And again, this is Gary LeBeau, former state legislator. I know that you've co-authored
some legislation.
Some legislation together, Colin.
I'm going to have to break ranks with Gary on this one. I mean, once again, this belies the whole notion. One of the things that you'll hear the quasi-publics or the people defending the quasi-publics, I should actually single out my good friend and colleague Kevin Rennie for having supported as a state legislator the conversion of the state lottery agency to a quasi-public. I think Kevin would take that one back right now. But when they defend it, they say it's more like a corporation. Well, it's not like a corporation because, in fact, Gary LeBeau could not show up on the doorstep of a corporation, have a meeting, and get a $75,000 contract to do God knows what. Basically, as far as I can tell, kind of introduce people from Connecticut Innovations to people in government, which should seem to be a pretty – I mean, isn't that what Connecticut Innovations does in the first place? So I don't understand it either. The optics are just terrible, and it also reinforces the pattern, which we've seen lots of times, of these quasi-publics being parking spaces for former legislators. This is not the first time this happened. We know it's happened a lot at CRRA, for example. You know, and that's obnoxious and offensive too. I mean, this should not be a career extension plan for former state legislators.
And then when you go to the unions and you say, look, I need you to take a pay cut. I need you to pay more for your health insurance. I need you to weaken your pension. And you're like, and by the way, we also are not going to be raising taxes because we're in a period of austerity. Just don't look at these arrangements with the pensions for politically connected people.
And isn't that really it? Isn't it just really hard to go to the bargaining table when you need to go to the bargaining table when that is the reality?
Look, Governor Malloy began his second term by doling out double-digit raises. And the defense was, well, my staff didn't get a raise in their first term. And a lot of people went 3-4 years without a raise. And then when you get a 12% increase and you're surprised that you can't get the unions to the table. We're not managing our message very well. There's not consistency.
We've got to take a break. Daniela Altamar is going to go cover. What are you covering, Daniela? What do you have to go cover?
Well, this morning at 11 o'clock, there's going to be a very important ruling that could change the way education is funded in Connecticut. So we'll find out more when the judge rules from the bench.
And Daniela, under what circumstances is this ruling going to be issued?
Excuse me.
She's got a Hillary Clinton attack.
Hillary Clinton.
It's contagious. The judge will be announcing his ruling from the bench this morning, and you know,
like TV cameras there.
TV cameras, and it'll be on CTN for those of you who are interested in watching at home.
And so this is very exciting.
Judge Judaization of the Connecticut judiciary begins today.
I want to thank Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Courant. Thanks so much, Daniela.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to talk about why we're going to be paying more for insurance. Oh, great. More cheery news. And we'll also be talking about new dog biscuits coming out of Danbury. That's coming up next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on my program Next, we're going to be taking a look at a pretty big drought that's happening across New England, especially in the state of Massachusetts. No, it's not like California or Texas, but it's getting pretty close for an awful lot of farmers. We're going to find out about how farmers and other people are just adjusting during climate change in a time of increased drought in New England. That's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Next. Today, we're taking a look at the week's news with Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR and Keith Fanna from the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org. Most Connecticut health insurance plan rates will have a steep rate hike next year, many increasing by double-digit percentages. The state insurance department approved 13 health policy rate hikes on Friday, averaging nearly 25% for individuals and 13% for small groups. Wow, Colin, this is a pretty big raise, and this comes after we've heard so much other news around health insurers. We've heard news around health insurers leaving the Obamacare marketplace, including Aetna. I mean, are we supposed to swallow 25% increases next year?
Well, I mean, first of all, what's tempting to do is to look around for a villain. Like, okay, so whose fault is this? Are the insurance companies really greedy? Is Catherine Wade an ineffective insurance commissioner because she is a creature of the insurance companies? And by the way, Harriet Jones did some really excellent reporting about this today. I would really recommend anybody. We should actually just play the piece again. It was so good, you know. And I think it points to the idea that looking for those kinds of convenient villains is probably not going to work very well. The problem may be more structural at the kind of Uber level of Obamacare. I mean, there's some significant ways in which Obamacare kind of doesn't work. It didn't have the two things that would probably have enabled it to work. One of them was a public option, which was just a no-fly because the insurance companies didn't want to have to compete with a public option. Now we find out why. And it didn't really have effective cost controls. So without those two things, you're basically running a poverty program. I mean, basically what's going to happen to Obamacare probably, and this is not an original thought with me, is it's going to kind of devolve into something that looks a lot like Medicare. It's going to exist for poor people and sick people who need insurance. And to that extent, it's done a pretty good job of supplying insurance to people who didn't have it, who needed some kind of crude insurance instrument. That's the thing it's been good at. But the thing it was sold at as – I mean, ironically, it was sold to a very alarmed and fearful American public as a government takeover of healthcare. It's anything but. I mean, there's only 12 million people in the exchanges right now. So it's not that at all. It was probably never going to be that. And what's tragic is it may just devolve into this program for a very select group of people who can make some kind of use of it. We may actually have squandered our chance to do something much more substantial, something that would have reached a lot more people.
Well, the other thing, and this goes back to what Colin said, people knew this was coming. It's now you're seeing the cost shift away from the government and onto consumers. You're seeing costs, medical inflation driving these rate increases, but you're also seeing an end to certain federal payments, risk stabilization payments that were coming that are not coming anymore under the Affordable Care Act. So the insurance companies are raising the rates, and this is something that people anticipated quite a while. But yet Obamacare was kind of sold as, well, don't worry, the government will pick this up, and as long as my taxes aren't going up, I guess the government's finding the resources somewhere else. That's kind of the implied message. No, what's happening now is the insurance companies are passing these costs along in big increases to consumers.
The one thing the insurance companies were intellectually honest about from the very beginning of talking about any kind of healthcare reform is we would need everybody. Okay, we'll do this, but we need everybody in the pool. You know, we can't be assigned a whole bunch of people who have high needs and not a countervailing group of people who don't have high needs, hence the incredible push to get healthy young men, you know, into this pool. But it hasn't really worked. You know, and if they don't have everybody, if they don't have a gigantic pool that includes a lot of people who right now don't have to make a lot of claims, it's not going to work. And, you know, in that sense, I mean, it is why – I'll just say this one more time. A public option would have been a really great thing to try.
But given what we've learned on this, I mean, in – politically in Washington right now, it doesn't seem as though the public option is something that's going to be resuscitated anytime soon. But have we really squandered our opportunity to do this? Is this never coming back? Because at the end of the day, I mean, we need to figure out a way over the course of the next decade or so to bring the costs of getting health care down. It's not health insurance. It's actually health care, being healthier in America, down. And we don't seem to be doing that anywhere close to as quickly as we should.
Well, we recently had a pretty convulsive, that's an unintentional pun, conversation about the EpiPen, right? I mean, you know, that's turned into a symbol of something that costs way too much. And Hillary Clinton, as part of her campaign now, is proposing a solution to that. I mean, that's – when to talk about nibbling at the corners. I mean, that's a real thing, and addressing it is a really important thing to do. But, I mean, if you don't do it comprehensively, if you don't look for some mechanism to do really significant cost controls, fixing the EpiPen problem isn't going to solve much of anything except the EpiPen problem.
But, of course, and we've read just this week, Keith, you need another one of these lengthy International Business Times pieces by David Sirota, who's been going after the Malloy administration on a number of different fronts and going after the health insurers on a number of different fronts. And there is this sense that maybe we're not able to find the specific villain in why our healthcare system hasn't worked the way it should, but it does seem clear as though the health insurance industry has been very, very tight with many parts of the political industry in a way that makes David Sirota and many other people feel comfortable. I mean, if the insurance companies are going to help call the shots on how we do things, well, maybe we're going to end up with a system something like this. Clearly, it hasn't worked well enough for the insurers, or else they wouldn't be fleeing the Obamacare exchange. But it clearly hasn't worked for us. And as you mentioned earlier, that's the whole point. It's supposed to work for us, like the people who need stuff.
And I think almost sometimes we spend too much time looking for the villain and not looking for the problem, or sticking with the villain theme, looking for the doomsday bomb. The problem is we have had a situation for far too long where too many people in this country are underinsured or uninsured. You're trying to find some way to get them all covered, get them to a doctor, have whatever issues they have addressed. So instead of having to pay for an expensive heart surgery, you can pay for treatment so they don't have a heart attack or need a bypass in the first place. There's no clean and easy way to pick that up, to pick up that problem that doesn't cost money. And we're paying for a legacy of not valuing healthcare as a society as we should. There are still too many Americans who have no regular access to healthcare, who have no relationship with a doctor.
As people may have heard, though, of course, this morning on Morning Edition, Colin, there is a big lawsuit in Canada, though. I mean, people are waiting an awful long time to get healthcare, and there's some thought that the Canadian system of this kind of Medicare for all that many people have proposed here for the United States really doesn't work, and that case is, you know, really the example of why not.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there isn't any perfect system. By and large, the Canadian systems work pretty well. And I haven't followed the policy closely enough over the last 3 or 4 years to know whether it's deteriorated. Of course, there are going to be instances where people are waiting too long for things, you know, and you don't want that. You want to control for that. I mean, certainly when you compared that with what we had prior to Obamacare, where people were just basically dying, you know, because, in fact, they couldn't get treatment they needed. They weren't waiting for the treatment. It just wasn't ever coming. So, I mean, you want to step from that at least a little bit closer to a system where you can get the treatment. But, you know, just to the point that you're making, some of the stuff Sirota's turned up is, you know, it is disturbing. It is. There's this one paper trail that he came up with that has like all the invitations to one of these big DGA events. And it has, did you see this one? It's like, what you get for $100,000, you know? It's this participation in policy discussions. And so this, first of all, this is like this chance to go away for this weekend and play golf with a bunch of governors who have 38% approval ratings, you know, and then participation in policy discussions. What's that? What kind of policy discussions are you participating in for $100,000 at your golf weekend? I mean, you know, the forces that created the Bernie Sanders rebellion and the Donald Trump rebellion are right there on those pieces of paper, right? Well, the thing that people are really upset about in this country right now is this notion that, back to Keith's point about quasi-publics, that these things don't exist to function on behalf of the taxpayer, that there's a whole bunch of people, very powerful interests, who intersect with the public sector and who can milk it like a cow and get all kinds of things that they want out of it. And then the dregs, what's left, you know, goes to the taxpayer. And that's why you have angry Trump supporters and angry Sanders supporters saying, I don't even know that this guy, Donald Trump, could do anything, but I'd just be happy to see somebody burn this system right down to the ground.
Well, and I think part of it, too, it's not just milking the system, which we always knew was happening, Keith, but in increasingly brazen ways. The stories we told earlier about quasi-publics and people getting these lifetime pensions and these big bonuses, things like, you know, $100,000 gets you a policy discussion with the state governor. I mean, these are indeed things that are coming as close as possible to just shoving it right in people's faces. So there's no surprise that people are going to be fairly upset.
It seems like the history of government is it's very slow. It's reactionary, but it's a very slow reaction. And I just think you're going to see over the next few years, as the bill comes due, as despite whatever you promise, your taxes keep going up and your services keep going down, you're going to see a public more tuned into this, less tolerant of it, and then the politicians will have to adjust and react.
Okay, so given you mentioned Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, some of the revolutions that have been happening this week, now we see this week both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein are officially on the Connecticut ballot. I mean, I don't know what it means necessarily, Colin, but these are a couple of viable options now for people to vote for in November.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, I just got back from Maine where Paul LePage was elected to a second term. I mean, Paul LePage is like a dysfunctional idiot. And one of the reasons he got elected was there was a three-way race, and so there were sort of two anti-LePage opponents that helped him win an election he might not otherwise have run. So people should always remember things like that before they get really excited. And I said this a few weeks ago, but I don't think that these are impressive candidates. I mean, Jill Stein is a kook. And, you know, the idea that the Green Party can't come up with somebody a little bit more substantial than her is it's a discredit to the Green Party. And Gary Johnson at least has some governing experience. So does his running mate, Bill Weld. I don't know. I listened to the David Remnick interview with him on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
With Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, with Gary Johnson, you know, which I get to hear on my way to church. And like at one point, Johnson just started yelling at David Remnick about guns. He was just like yelling, and he really hadn't been provoked in any significant way. He just started screaming about guns. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't find this particularly reassuring if I were thinking about voting for Gary Johnson, which I'm not.
Okay, so we just have a couple of minutes left. And Colin, we have a really interesting story this week. The man who brought you awkward hip-hop dialogue on Twitter, the mayor of Danbury, Mark Boughton, has his own dog treats?
Right. So the gubernatorial field for 2 years from now is beginning to sort itself out. And we know that Mark Boughton, you know, would be one of the lead dogs in that dog pack.
Nice.
And it turns out he's getting his own dog biscuits from Stu Leonard's. Stu Leonard's noticed, I guess, the grocery store chain in Connecticut noticed that Mark, in his almost obsessive use of social media, is often posting pictures of his dog, who I think is named Ellie. And so they an in-house, almost artisanal dog biscuit
really,
that includes Wisconsin cheddar cheese and all kinds of other lovely things.
Couldn't have found Connecticut cheddar cheese, but
yeah.
Fine.
So, yeah. So he's got now his own dog biscuit named after him. Take that, Themis Claridis, Peter Lumage, Tim Herbst, et cetera.
So I suppose that's something. Any last thoughts for you, Keith? Anything interesting in the news that we haven't talked
no
about?
No last thoughts. Every thought,
I can't. I can't top that. I'm sorry. Anything I say is going to come up horribly short.
Well, I mean, one thing that we could do, I'll volunteer my email address. If you can think of some products that Stu Leonard's could name after some of the other potential, you know, I guess we could throw Lembo in there on the other side too.
Sure.
Stuff that you think Stu Leonard's could name after, products that, because it seems unfair, you know. I mean, if he declares for office, I don't know. How are we going to handle the dog treat named after him? Is that some kind of in-kind contribution or something?
I think it is.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. I mean, look, if the Elections Enforcement Commission couldn't control Dan Malloy the last time around, imagine Mark Boughton with his own dog biscuit.
I'm going to run with some brand name kitty litter.
Yeah. Okay, so I just have to say, there's something that I've been thinking about that's a big news story back where I come from in Pittsburgh this weekend, but it actually has a UConn tie-in. UConn has been talking about joining the Big 12, and the Big 12 is one of these conferences that got blown up because of all of the conference reshuffling and realignment over the course of the last couple of years. A lot of traditional rivalries went away, and rivalries in a lot of ways is what makes college sports something that we care about. You play the same team every year, and even though the players always change, the uniforms stay the same, and the people can root against the other team. For 16 years, we haven't had a Pitt-Penn State game. And it's back this year. The University of Pittsburgh and the Penn State University haven't played because of these conference realignments for quite some time. And this year, this is back. And I'll just say, it's really good for college football, and it's really good for my hometown of Pittsburgh. And this is the sort of thing that people who like college sports should be looking to do more of, not less of. UConn, probably in a Big 12 filled with a bunch of Texas teams, doesn't make as much sense as a UConn closer to home. But anyway.
Yeah, I've never figured out, like, who is UConn's natural rival in football?
I don't know that they necessarily have one. They played Maine and they beat them, but they didn't play all that terribly well in the first game of the year. I'm not sure. Just 30 seconds, Colin. Any last thoughts from you?
I'll do one quick recommendation because I was off for a week, so I had a life for a week. So
good for you.
I'm going to recommend the movie Sing Street, which is it's actually done by the guy who did Once, which I didn't like particularly, but once again, it's about young Irish kids who are misfits in their middle school, putting together a rock band. And actually has really, like, maybe they're early high school students, but actually has really good songs in it, too. So Sing Street, it's on cable, you can get it.
Colin McEnroe, Keith Faniff, thank you so much for joining us in The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We'll see you next week.